I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, Joe Sestak, is running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania and a chance once again to take on Republican Pat Toomey in the fall. Sestak lost to Toomey by 2 percentage points 6 years ago after defeating Arlen Specter in the primary. Specter had switched parties to run as a Democrat, and Sestak had defied his party leadership by running against Specter. His independence still rankles his party. The leaders, including President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden, have endorsed Sestak's rival Katie McGinty, even though Sestak supported a number of the administration's key legislative initiatives when he served in the House of Representatives, representing Pennsylvania's 7th District. The Philadelphia Inquirer endorsed Joe Sestak this past Sunday. A year ago, he walked 422 miles across Pennsylvania, a walk, he said, to earn voters' trust. Before his time in Congress, Joe Sestak served in the U.S. Navy and became a three-star admiral. Joe Sestak, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. You are wearing the shoes that you wore across the state, and they're kind of beat up.
They are. Marty, first, it's great to be with you, and they are. And after about 600 miles, because I continued walking on the northern tier in between cities, like between Wilkes-Barre and Scranton, and I did an event, for example, each time on Dress for Success, lower-income women, how do they get into the workforce properly. But my daughter, as I mentioned to you, finally gave me a new pair for Christmas.
But you're still wearing these
ones. They're the old ones.
Let me ask you just a couple of strategic questions, and I do want to get to some policy questions. One is, how do you think 2016 is different from 2010? Yes, you came very close to defeating Pat Toomey, about 80,000 votes, 51% to 49%. And that was the year, I think, the president talked about the shellacking that the Democrats got. But how is 2016 different?
I think it's different that what was very apparent to me back in the summer of 2010 is very blatant today. And that is that we really are in a fight for the soul of America because, frankly, Americans don't trust either party's leadership anymore. Look, I used to say I'm running with the Tea Party. I may violently disagree with their policies. We both felt the establishment let us down. And so today, as I'm running as composed in 2010, is I went to teach. I turned down the lobbying jobs, the million-dollar lobbying jobs, because I wanted to start to earn the trust if I ever got back in. And what I did is why it's different is we came so close, within 2 points, outfunded 3-1, the largest funding gap of any Senate or governor's race in America. Our gubernatorial candidate, if you remember, lost by almost 10. But we tried to walk in their shoes that race. And so I've doubled down on it. The only difference is to truly make sure that I address the biggest deficit we have in America, the trust deficit. And so that's why I think back then it was new, but now I really am emphasizing how can I earn your trust? Because I don't want to just win, Marty. I want to govern, and you can't do it without trust.
Do you trust the leadership of the Democratic Party, of your party?
What I think is that Washington, D.C. power brokers have actually done something with their power, which is they've forgotten it is about people. I can remember one of the wisest words I ever heard was by a Republican, Boehner, the majority leader, when he handed the gavel to Nancy Pelosi in 2007 because their party had taken a shellacking. He handed the gavel over and he said, "My party forgot that power is not to be used for power's sake, but for people." And I think at times that Washington, D.C. really does believe that it is just about the vote when it isn't. It is about earning the trust of people and galvanizing them, because if you don't, then you absent the battle space and you have the Trumps of the world fill it. And that's why we're in a fight for the soul of America. Where are our titans in the Senate on the Democratic side that day in and day out galvanize people to the right ideas for America?
You're saying there are no such leaders in the Senate today speaking to these Democratic principles?
I think there are good senators down there, but I think we don't have the titans of old. Kennedys of old that would roar. You know, you used to have someone, what, I didn't agree with them all his opinions, could actually stand there like a Sam Nunn as a Democrat or Hal Jackson, say, here's the right way. But today, when the Iranian Accord came in, on the Republican side, they just misrepresented it, went all everywhere, said, this is going to hurt us. But where were our Democratic leaders down there in the Senate? Instead of worrying about, well, I'm studying it, where were they to shape and to explain why this was in the interest of Israel and our security, of kicking the new capability out of Iran? Man, I picked up the phone, called Fox. I said, I'd love to come on an open town hall at Villanova University. Leadership is about galvanizing people to the right ideas in a thoughtful, fact-based way, and we seem to lack that today.
Another more strategic question to you. It is interesting. I did this in preparation for the interview, looking at all the initiatives that you did support coming from Republicans, certainly coming from President Obama. But do you feel that the president and the vice president who are supporting Katie McGinty have let you down?
Not at all. Look, I was out there fighting in the hardest of battles with President Obama. And we were Joe Biden. You know, we saved this economy, the economic stimulus bill. And I represent a Republican district. But I got reelected by 20 points, only spending $28,000 on yard signs. That's all I spent of the $3 million I raised. I was out there fighting to put a guard, a watchdog on Wall Street with Dodd-Franks. And I was out there for the Affordable Care Act so everyone had an opportunity. But I'm not asking the president to have my back today. Mm. I'm not asking, as I said in my commercial, to have my six, is what we say in the military. I would just want to have people six, because good leaders don't ask others to have their sixth. As a captain of a ship, I didn't ask the admiral to have mine. I wanted the crew to know I had theirs, and they would have mine. And that's how I'm running this campaign.
You said the word reelected, and I think going back 6 years, there was that, infamous statement by Arlen Specter about getting reelected. How much do you think that derailed his campaign? And
it's interesting. Not at all. I called Shane Inspector, his son, after the campaign, and he said, Joe, everybody thinks that it was that ad that did it. It wasn't. You put up your bio ad at Have You Served the Country and then got out for your daughter. Run that ad. He said, we had tracking poles. And every day you rose one and we went down one and you tied us on your bio ad. In fact, Arlen Specter put that in his book. It's so funny to show that truly if you show people that you will be there for them, as I was for the country in the Navy, joined up during Vietnam, as I went on the ground in Afghanistan, headed terrorism, or how I got out to take care of my daughter and fought in a Republican district for the Affordable Care Act, people then will say, he's got our six. And that's what most matters. And that's why it was the other ad that actually won it.
Let me ask you one more question. And it's clear you are a maverick within the Democratic Party, but you are also a Democrat. How much do you think, though, relationships between Democrats in the party matter, whether it's taking on the Republicans or refining or coming up with initiatives?
It's absolutely critical. And that's why I was called the most productive congressman my first 2 years down in Congress by Steny Hoyer, majority leader of the Democratic establishment in the House. 20 pieces of bipartisan legislation were done by me. I moved the first money into autism and research in 12 years because one out of every 45 children born today in America and Pennsylvania have autism. I did the first Elder Abuse Act in 17 years, bipartisan, got it through the House. Why? Because in Pennsylvania, we have an increase every year of 35% in elder abuse. I was a senior in my district who was beat with a belt buckle, had dementia. I had to sue Wachovia Bank, bring a court case against to return $25 million it let telemarketers take away from my seniors. And then I took a Republican to Walter Reed Military Hospital, showed him that the traumatic brain injury of our soldiers coming home is 360 degrees because the blast from an IED goes inside the helmet and can't get out and ricochets around. And I said, we have a deficit of occupational and physical therapists. And he was an occupational therapist. He helped me get forgiveness for loans for those who would go into those fields. And then in my Republican district, I won, as I said. I kept the office open 7 days a week, Marty, to 9 o'clock every night. It was the recession. I rotated interns under my staff. We handled 18,000 of my countrymen and women, saving almost 1,000 households, about 650 or 7. Couldn't save the rest. And that's, in my mind, is four times the average congressional office. And so we do well within the establishment, but that doesn't mean I buy off in their direction of what to do and fight for people.
What did you learn walking across the state of Pennsylvania?
It was
amazing. That you didn't know before.
Let me tell you, it just personally was liberating to be out there and actually see things as you're walking through like Westmoreland County and at 5 a.m., yep, those farmers are getting up at 5 a.m. with the lights coming on. But what it doubled down on is Americans are still great. Two quick examples. I got offered a ride by over 40 people from an 18-wheeler who stopped to a young
woman. Were you hitching? Did you have your hand
up? No, it was a walk. And they just
stopped.
And then I was walking up a mountain and a woman came down, young woman said, "Hey, can I help you? Would you like a ride?" Except the bus stopped here during the snow the second day, said, "Get in." I said, "No, I'm walking across Pennsylvania. I know who you are. Joe, get in." And then finally, a Republican came out of a car dealership, Marty, as I was walking. I just did an event at the Sinkhole Saloon, which is where a hole sinks because we don't have enough funding for transportation to fix the hole in front of it or to keep sinking. And as I was walking away, I passed a car dealership. A Republican came out, and I had my flight jacket on, and he looks at me and yells out, "Admiral Sestak, I'm a Republican, and I love what you're doing." No, there is the great opportunity to bring us together again. We are the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, United States of America. Yeah, we should have a bitter debate of ideas, but come together with a principle compromise without compromising principles at the end.
You have said, and I'm going to not paraphrase it perfectly here, but I believe you were talking with an editorial board in one of the newspapers in Pennsylvania talking about money campaigning as a form of prostitution. Can you expand on that?
Yes. What I made it very clear, it's crystal clear that I was talking about what Citizens United had done to the system. And it's unequivocally clear I was referring to myself, where a senator said to me, "Sestak, whenever I tell you anything, the only answer will be yes." And another senator had said to me, as we were trying to work together with the establishment of this race, "Joe, we do this to everyone."
And meaning really, you pay the piper?
Yeah, you follow the dictums of the power brokers down there at the Democratic headquarters in Washington, D.C. "Sestak, whenever we tell you anything, the only answer would be yes." And then they put in millions of dollars, well, $1.5 million against me. I think Citizens United money really has. 433 congressmen and senators have taken a lobbying job since 1998 when they left Congress. Man, I turned down number of these jobs, over $1 million. And my wife kind of chuckled, put a hand on my shoulder, Marty, and said, "Are you sure, Joe?" But we do it in Harrisburg. People rove off. And that's why people have lost trust. And Citizens United, as I was referring to, only opened it up more, Marty. And that's a shame.
About a minute before our first break here, what can you tell us about the Super PAC Accountable Leadership? And they are in support of you.
Yes, yes. This PAC arose and I didn't even know the name of it till they put up the first ad. My limited knowledge of it, it arose because, again, those power brokers down there closed down a group that has traditionally supported me. And it's interesting. I loved the name after I saw their first ad, Accountable Leadership. And so my take on it is that's exactly what our nation needs, someone who is willing to be accountable, not just for the words of their deeds. I went to over 200 African-American churches. I went to three this weekend in my last race against Specter. They welcomed me. It's why I went to Cheney University, the old historic Black universities, pay them back by being a teacher. Mm-hmm. I actually hired my third person was an incarcerated African-American who I taught there. Great person. But I remember what a deacon said to me when I left. "Joe, I'll know when you're good when what you do speaks so loudly I can't hear what you say." And that's what I'm trying to do with accountable leadership.
And that is Joe Sestak, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania, a series of one-on-one interviews that we are doing with all the candidates. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. And if you're just joining us, Joe Sestak is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He served two terms in the House of Representatives, and he is running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate. He lost by just 2 percentage points in 2010 when he challenged Republican Pat Toomey. We are talking about his passion for politics, and we'll be talking about some of his policy statements as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me go back to, and this is something I asked Katie McGinty last week when she was on the show, and this is about Social Security and Medicare. She has said that you have wanted or want to cut Social Security, raise the retirement age, and cut benefits, and I want to give you a chance to respond to those charges.
Yes, she said that during the debate, and the next evening, the ABC, which hosted the debate in Pittsburgh, said that was misleading. The Post-Gazette out there, the paper, said it was actually not accurate. And they actually pointed out that Joe Sestak, I voted over 40 times to enhance and protect Social Security. I do believe that we're going to have a problem in 2030. And much like we saved Medicare was about to run out of money next year, and the Affordable Care Act saved it until 2030, that if you look at the great compromise between Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan back in the 80s, 90% of all wages were covered. Today, only about 84%. And this is in my book, by the way, so it's very – and I've said very clearly on radio, don't raise any ages. Do not. Don't cut any benefits. But it shows in my book, and as I've said on radio and television, that all that money that was lost because only 83, so many people had less income and less, went all to the top 1%. And so just like that movie, follow the money in order to balance. But don't cut any benefits and don't. And that's why I voted all those times to enhance it and consistently, including in my book, laid out the right way to do it.
Well, we don't have time to get into all the details, but what about just raising the cutoff? I believe it's something like $118,000.
That is correct.
No, raise it up.
That is one that some people, but that's not mine. Mine is follow where the money went because, as you well know, if you follow the money in the last decade, all of that money has gone to the top 1% almost exclusively. So I think that's the more fair way of doing it.
Which is what? Not letting people, the high-income people, have access to the benefits?
Yes. If you get $1 million, up to $118,000 is Social Security tax, and the rest is not. But if you remember, 90% of all wages of working people were covered before. Now only 84% is because today, over 50% of the working families in Pennsylvania and America are earning $2,000 less in real income than 1999. That wealth has gone all the way up to that millionaire who now has $2 million, and none of that that what used to be down here has moved up here. That's that income inequality that people have talked about. And I believe in fixing it by economic mobility, by the proper investment into education, which I call our homeland defense, and small businesses that create 70% of all jobs are only be creating half as frequently as they did 20, 30 years ago. But in this case, that's where all our working families' money went to cover Social Security. It's up there at the very top.
So go get it.
Yeah,
take it away.
To balance it. And so that's the proper way to do that.
Well, let's talk about the economy. And you said it. I don't think our listeners need any deep reminder that so many people are still recovering from the recession. Even before the recession, for a lot of middle-class families, basically the wages have been stagnant. You mentioned this just a second ago, but how – I mean, education – seems we should make sure that all children get a really good education in this country, but that takes time. It's a complicated solution. Are there things that can be done now to help people now who are struggling and in some cases even suffering?
Absolutely. On the education front, there are things that can be done now. I joined up during Vietnam where they used to say the Navy or jail to people. Well, that doesn't happen today. But one of the things I did after I didn't win is I taught at 5 colleges and universities instead of lobbying. And that I also worked on a foundation here in Philadelphia for the lower income where we placed money for pre-K, which will take time to see the benefits of that, but also for those that I talked about to get off the track in high school. Now, here's the example. You go to Acker Shipyard here, the old Philadelphia Navy Shipyard where my father worked, and I visited every year as a congressman. 180 welders work there who come from outside Pennsylvania. So I went to the community college and I said, why aren't you training them to be welders? He said, Joe, I've tried. I can't get the skills. Come here. I'll show you the welding today. It's different than when you had the welders in the Navy. Back then, you lit the arc, flipped the helmet, lay the bead. Today, you got to sit at a computer in that shipyard to design the bead. I can't get the kids when about only one-third of males, are graduating from high school in Pennsylvania to do it. So what you want to do and what we did is try to match them up proper for adventure and where there's a grant from the government that facilitates, and more does that here, where you get them into a community college overseen for the training by the private industry like the welders here to get them trained to be a MIG or TIG welder. Those are things we can do now. Here's the problem. Only 5% of all our colleges in Pennsylvania Community Colleges, that first step up, that immediate first step up, but a less expensive one, across the nation, it's 25%. That's why we need to invest.
More kids in community college?
Oh, my gosh. There's 62% of youth across America are in community college. In Pennsylvania, it's only like 28%. Mm. So there are things in education that can be done immediately. The second adverse side of that is small businesses. My gosh. Small businesses, and I was vice chairman of small businesses, can't get access to starting up. 70% of all jobs are created by small businesses every year. But we only have 18 being created per 10,000 working Americans. It used to be 36. We need to do what Wisconsin did right away. They said if you invest in a new small business, you're the investor, you get 50% tax credit on your investment up to $1 million. They quadrupled the investment into new small businesses. Things, look at the source. And these are the real reason why this is important for Pennsylvania. Look over the last 40 years. Our growth in small businesses has been half the nation's average. Therefore, our job creation has been about half the nation's average. We are the second oldest state because the youth go looking for jobs elsewhere. Small businesses, relieving the regulation on them, giving access to capital, creates those jobs that give demand for labor. You train them through the way I talked about, and you can be moving this pretty darn quickly.
Where do you stand on things like a living wage or increasing the minimum wage? And that could affect a small business, especially if they're just getting started.
Great point, Marty. And as I lay down the book after research, because you need to do this in a practical way, that if you do not raise the minimum wage above 50% of the average hourly wage, no jobs are lost. We have a test case. New Jersey, about a decade or so ago, raised it to 47% of the average hourly wage, and their border is right next to ours for fast food and ours. We didn't raise ours. No, over the next couple of years, no more jobs were lost on their side. So right now, today, and by the way, there's statistical studies on this, that if we could raise the minimum wage to $10.80 immediately and no jobs are lost, then you index it to inflation. And as wages increase, then they keep increasing to that $15 level. I actually voted to increase the voting wage when we went down there, and people tend to forget that it was a three-step process. Do we have to do it? Absolutely, for two major reasons. Right now, the minimum wage today is only 60% of what it was in the 1960s. And in addition, these are adults working there, particularly women. I think it's about two-thirds of those minimum wage are women, and about two-thirds of them are the major breadwinner for their families. This has to be done, but done in a pragmatic way, as I laid out.
Without hurting small business.
Absolutely. And that's why it's half the average hourly. We researched that in the courses that I taught. And so that's why you need to do it in a pragmatic way and then index it to inflation.
$10 an hour better than what we have now, but still I'm trying to imagine a family or a single parent making, what, $20,000 a year with one or two kids? That's still, if not poverty, just an inch out of poverty.
It is just there. But what we are able to do is not harm them. By the way, when I first did the study about a year and a half ago or so, it was $10.25. It's already gone up because the average hourly wage is going up. So we'll get like that three-step approach to 15 pretty rapidly. But I also believe this is that here's what someone else did, if I might.
Sure.
You could take Wendy's, which Cascade Engineering did. This is why it's not just the minimum wage, but it's joining people together. You talked about working together. And what happened is if you came in and worked at Wendy's for the minimum wage, Cascade Engineering every Saturday would start to train you for about 6 to 8 months. And if you stayed in that job, Wendy's had a steady worker. This person was working minimum wage, being trained, and then Cascade Engineering would hire them. That's the way government can, of the people, for the people, can facilitate moving us up.
That is Joe Sestak, and he's running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania, one of three Democrats looking to take on the incumbent Republican Pat Toomey in the fall. We got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499, a bunch of comments here as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just ask you one more thing before we get some callers in on the conversation. You have called for a moratorium on natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania. Why?
I did it in 2010 race, and I did it today. You learn in the Navy, if you don't mind me expressing it in our sailor way, piss poor planning gives you piss poor results. We know from Lycoming County to Potter County that we have methane migration and other damage. Part of this is that the EPA is forbidden by a 2005 law, I think that's when it was passed, called the Halliburton loophole, from coming in and inspecting our drinking water. We know that they use lead in the fracking material. And so therefore, if we can't inspect it and we're already having some damage, we don't want another Flint. And now's a good time to do it. Why? Because there's 70 wells that have been drilled and they aren't fracking them because they've ceased fracking almost because our pipes to get the natural gas out are completely filled. And so
We have a glut.
And so let's get it right. In the Navy, you learn, expect what you inspect. Get it right before you do it. That's all that this is. And then get to moving to alternative energies as rapidly as we can. $1 million put into natural gas gives you one job. $1 million put into like wind turbines gives you about five jobs. Why? There's 400 tons of steel there. That's real manufacturing. That really creates jobs.
Were you talking about closing the Halliburton loophole? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, that's one of the things we have to do. I sponsored that called the Frack Act to let them come in and do it. But our department, DEP, the Department of Energy Protection, when it began and gave permission for fracking, we have the Auditor General saying they weren't ready. They didn't have the right regulations, they didn't have the right manpower for oversight. And as you saw just 2 months ago, Range Resources had 47 violations reported that occurred in 2011, 12, 13, 14. All of them were supposed to be fixed within 90 days. None of them were. DP never found out about it, just somehow somebody else reported about it. And so if you can't get it right, take care of the Commonwealth. Because people have to remember the frack is they wouldn't even be able to do this today if the United States Navy, Marty, at your taxpayers' money, didn't develop the sonar that permits them to frack because they gave up without us doing it. So if I invested in them, I'd like a return on my investment, which is let's get it right and don't hurt our water. Like anthracite mining gave us $13 billion to destroy tributaries and land. Get it right. And then we could, you know, see about moving on.
It sounds like you're saying, and then we'll get to our callers, that these fracking companies, these natural gas companies, then owe the taxpayers a bit.
Well, they did. I went to talk in front of 60 natural gas producers after the election, you know, and I had been offered a job, a consulting job to work for them. I turned it down. But I went to talk to them and I said, look, I believe in rugged individual, and be all you might be, but I believe the Commonwealth has to all in it together. And I said to them, the Navy developed at millions of dollars your sonar. And the Department of Energy developed the diamond bit drill for you to go down and do it. So all I'm saying is taxpayers could have invested their money not instead of in you, they could have invested in a bond. How about a 5% return like I could have gotten on my bond? So when you're saying, you know, excise tax, you wouldn't be here today if we taxpayers had invested in your fracking ability through a sonar and through diamond drill by you came to all stop without us. So this is just fair return on our investment.
Let me get some callers in and I'll read some comments as well. We've got Linda from Springfield, Pennsylvania. And Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Joe. Calling first to thank you for your voting record on Veterans Affairs. And my question is, you know, do you think you'll be able to continue that focus? Will there be opportunities to continue to improve that system in the next Congress?
Linda, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Linda, thank you for the call. The answer is absolutely yes. Every Veterans Day, when I was a congressman and even this past Veterans Day, every Veterans Day of most armed forces, I go into a prison to visit my vets. I was at the Grady for Maximum Security Prison this past one, 150 vets, spent half the day with them. 47% are there for a drug or alcohol-related crime. There's a guy there from Afghanistan I met this last time. They came home. There was a recession. And then you have someone like a senator from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, who voted against the jobs bill for them, the mental health parity bill, voted against after he visited my aircraft carrier, voting to send me to war against Iraq, visited it, and came home and voted against nine straight VA bills. No, there is a way to do it. We must stress and focus upon that their mental health is number one priority, increasing it. Number two, get the caseworkers and fund them to get them through like I did when I was down there. With $10 billion, we voted the biggest increase in the VA in the history of the VA for mental health, traumatic brain injury, and for hiring caseworkers. There's more to be done, but without a question, is that a top priority? You betcha.
Linda, thanks for the call. Let me see what Melissa from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Melissa, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Congressman. I had a question about the super PAC that's supporting you. I'm glad that it hasn't disclosed its donors and that it's also run by your former media consultants. Don't you think that that's a conflict of interest? And also, don't you think that the group should disclose its donors?
Melissa, thanks for the call.
Thank you. I don't know who it's run by, but I do know that it has to disclose its donors, because it is not a one of those like is happening from other groups that are in here on the other side.
Well, there are groups that don't have to,
but this one does. So it does have to, and I have to absolutely agree with you that they should, but they will, because there's a requirement. For example, I think they have to do it when I have to do it with, I think, is April 14th. I think that's the due date. Are we on April
14th? No. We're close. The 12th.
The 12th, yeah. So that they will. But thank you. I believe in transparency, and that's why I submitted a bill when I was down there that said we should have public financing of campaigns. But, you know, I don't believe in unilateral disarmament either, even though I was asked by former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel to be on Plowshares, which has to do with the eventual elimination of nuclear weapons. But we're not going to do it by unilateral disarmament either. But I do believe in transparency, and I totally agree with you on that.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. About a minute before our second break here, you had mentioned the Iran nuclear deal. You co-signed an endorsement letter along with something like 35 other retired admirals and generals. What was the basis for your support?
Because it enhanced Israel's and America's security. They could have had a nuclear weapon, four of them, within 30 days, Marty, as you know. We kicked it out with tough diplomacy, sanctions that brought them basically to their knees. But it didn't take a weapon to do it. Now, they can go back and do it, but it would take them at least a year now. And we have 150 people that can go in and inspect, leaving modern technology behind it. But if we have to use our military, it's still there. But keep this in mind. I've been through the secret war plans in the and in an unclassified way. I can tell you this. We cannot find the Iranian submarines in the Persian Gulf, 19 mini submarines. Our sonar doesn't work there. So we'll pull our carrier battle groups outside the Gulf as they close the Straits of Hormuz, with about 40% of the world's oil flows through. And then we'll begin our strikes, which will take weeks to months in order to try to destroy the seven key facilities. But they have hundreds of missiles in the meantime that can rain down on Israel and our troops in Bahrain and other places. We'll do this. But if you can do it by a peaceful way, why not when the military option is over there? That's why we generals and admirals stood up and said, this is the right way to bring about security. Militaries can stop a problem. We don't fix them. And we don't have to fix this one. Diplomacy is doing it, but we're there if we have to.
We're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation with Joe Sestak. He is running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania, up against Katie McGinty and John Fetterman. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Joe Sestak. He wants to go back to the U.S. Congress. He's a former two-term congressman from Pennsylvania's 7th District and one of three Democrats running for the nomination for U.S. Senate. And to our Pennsylvania listeners, the primary is 2 weeks from today on April 26th. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Maria to join us, and I'll read some comments here. Maria, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Admiral Sestak. First of all, I wanted to thank you for your service.
Thank you very much.
Given your background, what do you see as the biggest national security threat today?
I think the biggest national security threat is these transnational dangers, which we brought forward in the Clinton administration's national security strategy of engagement, which I was responsible in the White House for overseeing and bringing together. They include things like disease that can actually flow across our borders, terrorists that can flow across our borders, drug cartels that can flow across our borders, diseases and climate change that actually is having the Navy today. And all the services actually say in a document it'll be one of the biggest sources of conflict in the future. We have to adjust to that. Number two is, I think, while terrorism, we have to keep our sharp eye on that. It's a tactical issue. It is in the Western Pacific, China. I was asked with John Fetterman and I were at the national security debate in Erie the other day, does it look like Japan is about to get nuclear weapons because of China and all? I said, look, let me tell you, for the first time since World War II, Japan has actually got an amphibious offensive brigade it's built up and says we're going to come to other nations' defense because China is actually dominating the South China Sea, four artificial islands with airstrips on it because it wants to own all the minerals underneath that for its economy. We have to make sure people understand we're the honest broker, not in a military-to-military way vis-a-vis Soviet Union, but just to calm things down and make sure this new behemoth of a nation coming on, which I backpack through back back in the mid-'80s when, as an individual, the first year they let Americans go there by themselves, and I saw it was going to be some superpower in the future. Mm. But we got to bring it in according to the rules of the road of international law.
How do you do that? How do you make China, as you say, behave?
We do it as we have belatedly begun to do it, is we have to bring it to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and actually be strong about why it is wrongly subsidizing its companies as they are doing illegally, wrongly. And number two, as our Navy, 60% of it has belatedly been moved over there, and I advocated this as a two-star admiral, putting them in Guam and other places, we have begun to sail through the South China Sea, not in a belligerent way, just through a territorial waters they claim is theirs, where it isn't, just to show this isn't how it's going to be. And then working with them on issues like North Korea. I believe this strongly because now is our moment with China, because its wages have gone up 15%, Marty, every year for the last 15 years. It is in a race for time to try to get an Aussie and Harry at home, which you and I remember those. And it's because of the single baby policy that just became a two baby policy. Manufacturing is about to come back. They know they're beginning to hurt. I know a businessman who closed 8 factories there, brought 6 to America. So they aren't quite going to be the economic behemoth they were. So we have an opportunity here to have a lot of influence to bring about a more peaceful transition of China into the international norms.
Let me just ask you something about ISIS. And again, we could spend a full hour on this. But you wrote a piece about this. You said, we must view it as a state. If we don't, we will continue to target the wrong objects militarily and diplomatically. What would be the difference from what we are doing now? They think of themselves as a state. They call themselves the Islamic State. What would are thinking of them as a state, how would that change how we deal with that?
This was written prior to the administration changing its targeting. And that's why I put it out. Not that they were going to listen to me particularly, but caliphate is a state, an illegitimate one, the size of Belgium, the population of Norway. And we were targeting just some of the refined oil is going out. My argument in that op-ed said, go after the crude oil, what's pulling it out of the ground, $2 trillion of assets there.
Meaning bomb?
Yes, and we have done that. Why? Because they were getting about $1 billion a year from that. Then I said, go after the centers that are collecting the money from extortion and smuggling and all. We finally did this. Hundreds of millions of dollars of cash has been destroyed. Why is this important? You need money in order to do 4, as they did, near simultaneous strikes from Paris to Egypt to Syria to Ankara. And so go after the source of a state's power, knock it under. Then don't treat it as just an international terrorist organization. It's that. And because then you just go after the heads. Then we have to, I said, most importantly, be a diplomatic leader, bring Russia and Iran together. And Russia's staying there. People think they pulled out. My gosh, they've got new types of helicopters, arms there yesterday. And so bring them to do the ground game as we bring them together as the Syrians, as Saudis read the 32 militias. We don't want to have troops on the ground there, but our diplomacy can have them do it as our air power knocks that out. But then how will it end? How will it peacefully end? And that's what we aren't addressing yet.
I got a lot of comments here. Let me read an email from Lee. He says, the cost for our children to attend college is out of control. Banks should not be involved in profiting from student loans. What is your position on reducing college loan debt?
He is exactly right. And that's why I voted to remove the banks out of the middleman. The Obama administration finally did this. But here's the real key, and he brought it up. The U.S. government in these direct loans now is going to make $125 billion in the next decade, because they're charging the wrong interest rate based on a 10-year Treasury security. That's when people used to pay their loan off by that period of time. Today, it's decades later. So if we base it on the 30 and the 10, and again, that's in my book, we will reduce the interest rate in half, and government makes no money, we return $125 billion to them. That's only one way to do it. But let's start forcing these colleges that have 8% inflation rate to say, you want our money? Pell Grants and student loans, we can condition it on getting inflation to normal inflation.
We have a question here. Who does at Joe Sestak support for president? Sounds like his policies are lined up with at Senator Sanders. You did support Hillary Clinton when she was running, against Barack Obama, the current president. Where do you stand today?
I haven't endorsed anyone because I've not asked anyone for an endorsement. But I do say that Secretary Clinton has the character, demeanor to be a very good commander-in-chief.
Is that an endorsement?
I also would know. But I would I like her to be president? Yes. Could I think she'd be a fine president? Yes, as I do Bernie Sanders. But I'd say to Bernie Sanders, he has raised the biggest scourge we have in America today, income inequality. The only difference I have is to fix it, it can't just be redistributing benefits and a more progressive tax system. We may need that. But you got to fix it by economic mobility. As we began this interview, what's the right education investment? Because that's our homeland defense. How do we get small businesses creating jobs? How do we get the fact that the pregnancy discrimination has a hole a Mack truck could drive through? And today, the largest percentage of increases in discrimination brought to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is no longer race. It's pregnancy discrimination. And they're laid off. That hurts income inequality. And by fixing the PDA, Pregnancy Discrimination Act, we can fix that. And in particular, we have to get children of color educated. Marty, half the children under the age of 3 years old are children of color. In 15 years, they will be our largest national asset in terms of numbers. If they aren't in terms of quality of education, of health care, we don't make it. It's all hands on deck, and that's why we have to focus there particularly.
Well, just a quick follow-up to that, because so much of education is handled at the local level. It's local school boards that make so many of the decisions. Much of the money comes from state legislatures. Certainly that's here in Pennsylvania. What can a senator do to help education in Pennsylvania?
Plenty. I mean, first off, as I tried to do, is grants that could facilitate universal pre-K that help state facilitate it. Second, by ensuring, as I did, voting for an increase in that funding for poor districts, which is a federal responsibility, and that we do fund that on it. And that when you have 42% of the youth here in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, 18 under living in poverty, got a problem. Third, it was my bill that saved the pilot program, where if you live in a – it's not just the teacher there – kids are coming to school hungry. And it was my piece of legislation that now has become law that said if you live in a school district where at least 40% of the census data shows you people take food stamps at all, you no longer have to take the paperwork home, try to get it filled out, bring it back to see if you can get a subsidized or free lunch. Everyone gets it there, because what's a few more potatoes as compared? So there is a myriad of ways that we can do it. And as I showed you, it was also, by the way, I got people to go become occupational and physical therapists can be forgiven $10,000 in loans. And plus, you can be a leader on it.
Let me get Gail from, looks like Bethlehem, to join our conversation. Hi, Gail. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Admiral Sestak. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your position regarding hydraulic fracturing in Pennsylvania. Really appreciate that.
Yes, thank you.
My question is, I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you feel about the incarceration rate in this country and your opinion on private prisons.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Gail.
First, in private prisons, we had a person who died in private prison in my county as a congressman. We took it, looked at it, and then had his Justice Department come in and actually eventually got that private company, which was from Texas, which had other abuses, fired. I believe this is a responsibility on the whole of the Commonwealth, that this is what we do as federal prisons do. Number two, incarceration. As I mentioned, the third person I hired had been incarcerated. I believe what George Bush said in a State of the Union, where he said every person who walks out of a prison deserves what every American gets, a second chance, and then put $300 million into recidivism. The incarceration rate of women in Pennsylvania has gone up 80% in the last decade. Why? And oh, by the way, the recidivism program for them, evidence shows, is different needs than it is for men, and we have to get that. Then we have to get these inane one-size-fits-all crimes on drugs fixed. Look, that man I hired was in prison, that in the old – you could get him in front of a drug court and he could be all he could be as he became once I hired him. There's a myriad of ways to do this, and this is a population we don't want to lose. We're going to need them.
We have a comment from Roger. He says, you voted for the bank bailout. To me, that makes Admiral Sestak unelectable. Can you defend yourself to Roger?
Absolutely. Look, the day that Lehman Brothers went down – the Secretary of the Treasury called us all on a phone. We got on a conference call, and he said, if we don't do something now, and this was, believe it or not, Bush's Secretary of Treasury said, we will have a depression greater than the Great Depression. We went down there, and I voted for it to try to salvage it, because in those banks were the pensions of our working families, of unions and others that were going down. I voted for that bill, which didn't pass the first time, and two things happened. That night, the stock market collapsed, and number two, the LIBOR, it's an overnight lending rate,
right.
shot up from 0.2 to 8%. That means your credit card the next morning would have had credit of about 2,000% because it's tied to it. And then we voted and got it through. That's the damage that could have been done if we didn't salvage it. But second, I then went on 13 radio and television shows the next day to explain it. And I was leaving Fox 29 at 11 p.m. at night here. They asked if I'd be on at 6 a.m. the next morning. I said, great, I'm able to explain my vote. I came in the next morning. The vice president was there. And I said, thank you for coming on. He said, oh, this is great. I'm able to explain my vote and listen and tell them why this was needed. She said, we asked all the congressmen in the area to come on. None would. I want to be held accountable as I began this interview for what needs to be done. And that's why I appreciate the question. But the logic behind why I did it is those pensions and everything wouldn't be there today if we hadn't acted.
Let me see what Rick from Yardley has to say. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Joe. Regarding your criticism of Citizens United, I'm wondering if you're aware of a law that was contested and then overturned. It was called the BCRA. And a provision in that law gave a penalty of 5 years in prison for leaders of not only corporations but leaders of associations such as the NAACP or the NRA. These leaders, it threatened them with 5 years in prison for speaking of politics. And that's as if you know, that Bill O'Reilly's or Rachel Maddow's are not doing electioneering when they're on air speaking freely all they want. Would you like to see that five-year prison sentence reinstated for leaders speaking?
Yeah, you know, Rick, I have to tell you, you've kind of gone off on a tangent, and both Joe Sestak and I are looking at each other. I'm not sure what the banking thing has to do with Rachel Maddow or Bill O'Reilly and people expressing their opinions, but
yeah,
see what you think.
Yeah, and I'm not sure about that, Rick. I'd have to look into this old law, but I don't think if somebody just speaks off all of a sudden for politics, I mean, maybe they shouldn't have. Like, I have the Hatch Act when you're in government, and if you're a military person, active duty, and you're in your uniform and speak out, you'd be reprimanded, but maybe 5 years in jail. But second, I want to speak about this. Do I think that there are those in power that should be held accountable? Sure. When I came out of one of those prisons and I met that Afghanistan vet who was in there for having several thousand dollars of drug money in his hands, he had fought the global war of terror. About 2 months later, HSBC Bank was found to have funneled for the Iranian terrorist organization, millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, and for the drug cartel, hundreds of millions of dollars. You know what our Justice Department did? They fined him about half a day's profit. And some reporter said to them, why aren't you bringing him up for criminal charges? And they said, the collateral damage of people pulling the money out of the bank. I wrote an op-ed that said, Justice D.C. style, here is a youth who fought the global war of terror and is in prison for several thousand dollars in HSBC Bank because people might pull their deposits in a corporation that is influencing Washington, all of a sudden says just a civil fine. Your overarching point is good, but let's focus it on what the real damage, where it's being done.
And we're almost out of time here. You're saying, and I certainly have heard this before, people saying, looking back at the recession, saying no one has gone to prison. I mean, no high-level person has gone to prison. Part of the problem was perhaps what they did was not illegal.
Well, here's the issue is that I don't – what you brought up is where we began again, accountability. They sent me to war. We never found those weapons of mass destruction. Pat Toomey and others said were there. They sent – the post-Katrina of our government could not – do a good job. And then the meltdown on Wall Street, who's been held accountable? No. What is that there is SEC, there's a revolving door between them and Wall Street, and the enforcement wasn't done properly on this, is what I believe.
Well, we are out of time. Joe Sestak, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And again, he is running for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania, a former two-term congressman. And last week we spoke with Katie McGinty. John Fetterman will be our guest next week, and we will have covered the three Democrats who are running for the chance to take on Pat Toomey, who is unopposed in the fall. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. Tell us what you think of the show. Also, tell us what you think about these one-on-one interviews that we've been doing on these statewide races here in Pennsylvania. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. We'll be right back.